My name is Dustin Kelly, but everybody calls me DJ. I'm prior Army, serving as both a Ford Observer and a military police officer. I've spent the last 14 and a half years as a police officer and detective in a large metropolitan police department. Two things that I've learned throughout my career. One, everybody has a story to tell. And two, the best stories are true. This is the DTD Podcast. And we're live. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the DTD Podcast. This week, we have an extraordinary guest who embodies the epitome of dedication, skill, and resilience. My guest embarked on a remarkable journey of service to his country right out of high school, joining the Navy in July of 2001. His journey took him through the rigorous training of BUDS, SEAL Class 242, setting the foundation for an illustrious career in the SEAL teams. Assigned to SEAL Team 2, he assumed pivotal roles as lead breacher, team leader, and various capacities during multiple combat deployments to the Middle East. His dedication and expertise didn't end there. In 2009, he detached from SEAL Team 2 to contribute his skills as an instructor at Naval Special Warfare Training Detachment, where he taught close quarter combat to East Coast SEAL teams. Transitioning from active duty in 2010, he considered his association with the SEAL Team 18, the reserve team, until 2012. Over the last 12 years, he has immersed himself in the world of hired gun security contract work, both in the United States and overseas. This is an episode that you will not want to miss. Please welcome the Vanilla Gorilla, Ben Wallach. What's going on, my friend?
What's up, brother? Thanks for having me on, man. That's a pretty sexy bio you gave there, Mia. My daughters would be like, my dad's not that cool.
Well, you know what? It's funny that you mentioned that, because we talked before this and we said we have to talk about your family, and we'll get to them because pretty upset with you last time. Now, I'm going to warn you ahead of time. I got a little bit of a cold. That's why I had some more cool stuff about you, but we'll get into it later on in your bio. But to save the voice so that we can talk about this, I want to get right into your childhood, though. And you told me that your dad was really important in shaping you for the SEAL team. So can we talk about that early family life and how that kind of slated you toward your life of service?
Yeah. So my childhood was a little bit, you know, interesting to say the least. So my dad is a very interesting character. He has this way about him that like some of the people in my family say that he's on the spectrum a little bit. Right. So you ever seen the movie, The Burbs?
Yes.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite movies. So Rumsfeld, Bruce Dern's character, that is my dad right there.
I mean, okay.
Yeah. He's an introvert. He never showed a lot of love to me, you know, as far as like touching or hands on anything. Like, I don't even remember my dad saying, I love you ever, like growing up, but he showed love to my brother and I, and well, my two sisters are 10 years younger than us, but he showed love to us in a different way by always taking us out to do stuff. I mean, all the time, like fishing, hunting. You know, we grew up in the west suburbs of Chicago. You know, it's not a lot of hunting, fishing stuff there, but we had an uncle that lived in Sandwich, Illinois, and we went there to his property all the time, you know, every other weekend, and that's what he did with us. You know, my dad was not into sports at all. Like, he grew up like going out to Michigan to the Menominee River, and his grandfather taught him, you know, all that kind of stuff. Hunting, fishing. You know, my dad was a tree laborer for 40 years before he retired. And so while most kids are, you know, playing baseball with their dads, you know, out back, you know, my dad did things with us in games. Like this one kid game I can remember growing up that like I thought was fun at the time, but I look back at it and I'm like, that's a pretty messed up game. Like, my brother and I would hide, we'd have to hide in the basement, pitch black basement. And at some point he said he would come down in the basement, all right, with a wiffle ball bat. And we'd hide, and then he would hunt us in the basement with his wiffle ball bat. And when he found us, he'd whoop us with it. I mean, within reason, right? You know, it's a wiffle ball bat. But the game was like, I just remember being like, it was so intense. And I could hear my brother over there, you know, trying to be quiet. And then my dad found my brother, and I can hear that wiffle ball bat smacking against his skin. My brother's like, no, dad, no. Ah. And then it's quiet now and nobody's after me. And it was fun. Like that's the kind of like weird games that, you know, my dad would play. And he just, everything that he did with us was just like pushing us, making us like, you know, he did tree work. He would make my brother come out like Sherpas, you know, and drag all the trees away while we did it. He missed Vietnam by a year, but, you know, he tells me repeatedly, he's like, if I was in Nam, I would have been Special Forces. And I'm like, you know what? I don't doubt it, Dad, because, you know, there's a quote from Terminator 1 where Reese is talking to Sarah Connor and she says something about the Terminator, like, you know, he can't be bargained with, can't be reasoned with, doesn't feel pain and remorse. And my dad is exactly like that. He just, he's just a machine, like a laborer machine. And like case in point, he came out. I mean, what did I graduate? I graduated Buds at right around 19. And he came out and he asked me repeatedly before he came out there, he said, can I do the obstacle course? And I was like, I don't care. Like, I'll just give you some camis and you can do it if you want. And cause he's an incredible climber. I mean, I'd watch him as a kid go up trees. I mean, just climbing like a billy goat up the tree with this giant chainsaw, you know, removing a huge elm tree in our hometown. But anyways, he comes out, you know, when I go up Bud's graduation, I put him in camis. We go out to the obstacle course. You know, there's no like check in, you know, there's no like, you know, like, you just go out there. Yeah. And what's funny though is there was two white shirts out there. Like before you go through, if you go through Hell Week, you get a brown shirt. These dudes had white shirts on and they were having trouble with the dirty name, which is this obstacle where you like jump and impale yourself on one log and then jump and impale yourself on another log. Anyways, my dad follows me through that obstacle course. I just did the obstacle. I'm like, how do you want to do this, Dad? He's like, well, just do it and I'll follow you. And I went at a pretty fast speed. I was pretty good at the obstacle course. He follows me all the way through it, does commando down that just giant, you know, platform that you go up and then you can either go under the rope or on top of it commando style. And he did exactly the same thing I did. And, you know, he got through it in probably 7-8 minutes or something like that. And those dudes in the white shirts were like, hey, who is that? And I was like, oh, it's a Master Chief from Team One, you know. But he, after that, he said, he was like, I want you to tell everyone that your old man did the O course. And I was like, fine, I'll tell him, Dad. But I'm not kidding you, DJ, like a month later, I was talking with my mom on the phone and she's like, your father, he is still sore from that obstacle course.
Well, how old was he when he went through it?
Oh, he's 67 now. So you do the math. I mean, I'm not good at math. I still count my fingers, right. Yeah, I mean, well, it's pretty impressive. So
let me ask you something about him though, because it's funny that you say he never told you he loved you. You don't remember that ever. You don't remember it for your brothers and sisters, but you speak so fondly of him when you talk about him. Can you kind of talk about the dissonance between that? Because it's so weird.
Well, like I know it is weird, but like he, you know, my mother's completely different. Like, you know, I mean, grossly saying I love you, you know, snuggling all the time, but I knew when he took us out, like he spent time with us. I mean, like laborers, like, you know, they got hard work, man. When they come back, you know, they're tired and he would come back and, you know, do stuff. I mean, even if it was like setting up a little thing with a pellet gun in our basement and shooting, you know, little action figures, you know, he would do that in the evenings, you know? I mean, if he wasn't doing labor or in his workshop, like where I heard Rush Limbaugh 24/7, you know, I mean, I hear Rush's voice today. And it's like nostalgic for me because like as a kid, that's the only voice I ever heard coming out of my dad's workshop. But I knew he loved us because that's what he did with us. And he did. So when I left for Buds, he did hug me, but it was like this weird, like where he put his arm and then like tapped me, you know?
You don't really connect to each other. You just kind of form a triangle
like, I love you. And I'm like, I love you too, Dad. But that's the only time, DJ, I've ever heard him say it.
Wow.
But here's the other thing. Like, you know, he was so invested in what I was doing in the military and like calling me all the time and asking me, like, I didn't need the affection in that way to know that he loved me and to know that he cared. I mean, heck, he went, when I was going through Hell Week, like he told me on the phone, he said, before I went through Hell Week, he's like, I know you're going to be miserable this week. I'm going to be miserable. Now, I don't know what, I didn't know at the time what he was going to do, but I talked to my mom, you know, a week or so after Hell Week. And she said that he was all that whole week, he was staying up. He was depriving himself of sleep. He was taking a canoe down to the river and canoeing up it and fasting and all kinds of crazy stuff. So that's why I know that, you know, I didn't need the affection to know that, that, you know, he loved me and my brother. I mean, he took us, go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to ask, do you think you took that forward as you, as a father, like looking at that, or do you think your style's a little different?
So my style is a little bit different in the fact that I am my mother, like personality wise, like my dad is a, you know, he's an introvert. I'm an extrovert on steroids. And, you know, every single human DJ could disappear off the face of the earth and my dad wouldn't notice for a couple months. Like he wouldn't notice. Like he really never leaves his property. He's got 70 acres of hunting property, except if he goes to Menards. And then during COVID, he couldn't go to Menards because he got kicked out of Menards because he stood up, because he wouldn't wear a mask, and he stood up on a pedestal and made a speech about it. He's just, you know, he took my brother and I, you know, one of those pictures I sent you, of me when I was a kid with that pack on. Mm-hmm. And then my brother and I at Canada, this growing up every year, he took us to this place called Quetico National Park, you know, about an hour and a half over the border. But it's one of those parks where you get in there, you pack in all your stuff for the week, and you just travel from lake to lake. You put your stuff on your back and, you know, you portage the canoes and you're out there out in complete boonies. You don't see anyone for days. You know, you might see actually Native Americans sometimes up there, but you know, he took us up there every year and made us carry heavy packs. Like, I mean, that, I don't know how old I was in that picture, but that pack was super heavy and it sucked. But it's that type of stuff that like I grew up doing that, like when I ended up going to Buds, I was kind of already like, you know, used to the suck.
Well, how was the relationship between your mom and him?
Like legitimately. So, they're both like, you know, they're both Christian folk. And my mom, like she says this at like parties and like openly, and she said it for years. Like when my dad told my mom that that you know, basically like, you know, it's God's plan for you to marry me. And my mom's like, oh, okay. And so she does. And then within like, you know, short amount of time after their marriage, she realized like this guy's, you know, a little bit odd, you know, he's just, you know, wasn't exactly what she thought it was going to be. And she'll say it at parties. She'll be like, oh yeah, I prayed that he would die, but he didn't. Yeah, she will. Yeah, she'll say that. I mean, I don't know. I guess I shouldn't say she's being 100%, you know, real, but you know, divorce really isn't in our family. Isn't like something we just, it doesn't really happen a lot in my immediate family. So she was like, I'm not going to divorce him, but like, maybe the Lord will just take him. Yeah. She says it openly. And my dad's like, oh yeah, I knew she was praying that, but God had other plans.
Well, I mean, I guess if they figured out a way to make it work, that's the best we can do with it. So
it's just like it's kind of like, what's that? I mean, you would know in the law enforcement community where like you're a hostage for long enough and then.
Oh, Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much what it is. So.
Well, I mean, that's good that they have a great relationship like that. I think we should probably move on past that. So,
yeah.
brothers and sisters, the reason I bring that up about their relationship is because I want to see how it mirrors your relationship. Now, you met your wife in high school. You guys are still together to this day. So parts of that ring true to your dad and your mom, but in other ways, it's completely different.
Yeah. I mean, my wife and I we grew up in the same church. We went to high school together. You know, we didn't date in high school primarily because, I mean, she wanted to date me. Now she'd probably disagree, but I couldn't date her because I knew if I dated her in high school, I was going to actually have to be her boyfriend, like, and buy things for her and stuff. And like all my money that I was working at this climbing gym in high school went towards buying paintballs, you know, to go paintball fighting with my buddies. So I'm like, I can't date this girl because I can't really actually, you know, spend money on her. But we ended up hooking up after I you know, my mom, she's the busy bee, you know, talking to her when she's home from college and then telling me, oh, Ben's in town on leave. And then it was one of those things, you should go see Aubrey. And it was kind of like a rekindled, you know, rekindled thing when I was on leave from Left Buds and was headed out to check into Team Two. And we kind of reconnected and been with each other for 19 years. So
was it pretty good though, having been through Buds and everything? Did you have a little bit more of a swagger to you when you met up?
She doesn't really care about, like, she didn't care that I was a SEAL, like none of that. I mean, I'm not going to say that she wasn't like, you know, thought it was kind of adventurous, you know, to go on this, you know, this embark on this adventure with me and going out to Virginia Beach and all that stuff. But she wasn't like, you know, taken back by my pedigree of, you know, what I just did or anything like that. She just, honestly, DJ, like my daughters will remind me this all the time. Like, how did you get mom? She's so beautiful. And you are a gorilla, which is true. Like I, you know, one of the things with my dad and my mom is like, my dad's a filth ball. I mean, he's not filth ball, but like he would come home from tree work. The dinner had to be on the table. He would eat his dinner sometimes on a table tray, and he would just get up and just leave it lay where it was. And so I had built those, like my mom just cleaned up everything. Like, you know, all my mom was just homemaker. That's all she did. And that she just took care of him. She was dumping food on my brother and I's plates all the time and barely ever even ate dinner herself. And so I carried that over to my marriage.
Oh, that's not good.
And Aubrey is not, you know, pretty not like that. So there was a little bit of conflict going on for a while. You know, I'm still a filth ball and she has learned to live with some of my behavior, but it wasn't like she was just going to clean up my plates where they lie. So.
Well, let's talk about your high school friends that you had. You guys messed around a lot. I need to know, cause you said you guys played and thought you were Delta Force and stuff like that, but were there any movies, because I know you're huge on movies and movie quotes and stuff, were there any movies that you really watched a lot? Because I'm going to be honest, I watched Navy SEALs. I still to this day think it's one of the greatest films ever made.
It is. I mean, it's, you know, tactically it's terrible. But the quotes, the characters, the actors, it's just a beautiful piece of art.
Absolutely.
I mentioned this in another podcast I did, but like the movie Predator, that movie was the foundation of like changing the trajectory of my life. Like I saw it when I was like 6 or 7 or something, real young. And I was obsessed with it. I mean, I originally wanted to go to SEAL Team 4, you know, when I was in high school, because before 9/11, the teams had like these areas of operation and Team 4 was the jungle team. And I was like, I got to get to Team 4 because I got to be in the jungle and I got to be patrolling in the jungle. And I have to say, 5 meter spread, no sound. Like I got to do Predator quotes.
Okay.
So, yeah. So that movie, it was, I mean, I probably seen, I mean, in high school when I was really, you know, knew I was going to Buds and all this stuff, I would watch that movie over and over again on the weekends and clean my dad's guns. And it was pretty lame when I think about it.
Okay. Well, you know, here's the thing. Tactically, how was that movie? Again, it's a beautiful piece of work. I'm not sure that it's tactically that sound either.
No. Arnold's patrolling with his M16 with a 203 on it, like Contra, you know. I mean, but Jesse Ventura's gun in that thing actually did shoot. Granted, like a quick, it would only do like a quick burst.
Right.
But yeah, the tactics in it are terrible. But again, it's just the quotes in that movie. I mean, the whole movie, the plot of the movie is just, it's the most amazing plot you could ever imagine. Like the baddest ass spec ops guy is going on a mission. And then the only thing that can hunt them is an alien.
Awesome. You know, I, to this day, I remember I saw it with my older brother at the Oakwood Mall Cinema. I still remember to this day. Yeah, I still remember. I mean, it was a huge piece of my history too.
That's awesome. Did you? So my dad said he saw it in the theater, but he didn't know anything about it. Like he just went with some friends, knew nothing about the movie, knew it was an Arnold movie. But he said that when the Predator vision would go on, he was like, what is happening? Like, didn't know it. And I'm like, oh, I'd give anything to watch that like in that position.
Yeah. So my brother is 5 years older than me. So he was a lot older than me when it came out. So he actually got me into the movie because I could have the supervision so you could get in without having to sneak in. So yeah, I saw that. I saw Die Hard 2 in the theaters. There's a bunch of them that I've seen in the theaters that I look back and I'm like, wow, that's, you know, that, Navy SEALs. I saw it in the theater.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a great time to be alive, I'm telling you.
That's like, I mean, that is, I mean, phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah. So going back to your childhood and hanging out with these friends, did anyone else, did you have the normal thing that people had where they're like, yeah, me and my buddy, we were going to join the military together, we were going to do this. Did you have any of that, or was it just kind of your goal?
No, so I actually... when we were talking before we went live, you know, I told you about a SEAL buddy of mine named Mark Robbins, who is actually a cop up in Northern Illinois, outside of Chicago. He's a narcotics guy, but he was part of my little, you know, group of friends or whatever. He actually went to SEAL Team 5, got his eye shot out and all that, but still was able to get into law enforcement. But we were supposed to go to Buds on like a buddy program. And then he ended up like not backing out, but he just didn't go in when I went in. And then he ended up in class 243, like a class behind me. But the other, my buddies really went in the military, but we just had this little group of guys to where we thought we were Delta Force, and we would like put on all black. And our big thing was like rock climbing. Well, we loved to rock climb, but we go to this place, Mississippi Palisades, not too far from where we lived, about an hour and a half, and rock climb all the time. But our big thing was like, we wanted to like infiltrate buildings. So we would grappling hook buildings, and then we'd climb up them, and then we'd like try to, we would sneak in our high school sometimes, just that. And but we never stole anything. We never vandalized anything. It was just like, can we infiltrate this building? And we acted like we were CAG guys, you know, doing it, you know, and we, you know, we did a whole bunch of stuff with like, you know, driving around in trucks and, you know, hitting people with water balloons and super soakers all the time. And that was just our thing that we did, you know, it was like wanting to do adventure after adventure, and I was kind of the ringleader of it, you know, which you can imagine. And we would just create, you know, ways to try to find adventure and act like we were special forces dudes. But.
Well, let me ask you, and it's kind of a basic question, but I really want to know, when you do all that in high school and you think about being what you wanted to be, and then you actually do it and you kind of look back on that, because I mean, it's a very short time between the two. You're 19 when you graduate from Bud. So you were doing that 2-3 years before that. How does it feel inside when you look back on it and go, man, I knocked it out of the park right off the bat?
Yeah. I mean, it was like going right into Buds, you know, and then like, you know, literally a year and a half later after I graduated and I'm a SEAL and don't know anything. I mean, you graduate Buds and SQT and it's like, you are nothing. You don't know jack squat, you know, but they, you know, none of my buddies would really done anything yet. They were just going to like a community college, or, you know, some of them had gone to college or whatever, but the majority of them weren't really doing much. And I was actually visited them when I was at Great Lakes. And I didn't make much money in high school. I was a 3-sport athlete. So I worked at a rock climbing gym. I made a little bit, you know, like $150 a month or something like that. But when I went in the Navy, I think, you know, E3 or whatever I was making like 900 and something a month, or 850 or something like that.
That's $1 million back then.
Oh, I thought I was rich, man. I had this credit card that had these lightning bolts on it. It was this Visa card. And my derelict high school buddies were always like wanting us to go out and put it on the lightning bolts. Oh, okay. But I wouldn't care. Like, I'd be like, oh, whatever, I'll just pay for this trip or whatever. Or we're going paintball fighting, I'll buy all the paintballs and what have you. But, One hilarious thing though is that when I had just showed up to Team 2 and I went on leave and came back home. Now I was the ordnance guy at Team 2. So, well, I started out as a new guy and then I did it for 3 platoons, which I wish I hadn't, because the ordnance department is the worst department you could ever work. I mean, you're in charge of all the optics, you know, all the weapon systems. You got to inventory everything. You got to replace everything on each trip. It's terrible. But unfortunately, when I showed up as a new guy, the older guy that was doing it was like, hey man, what department do you want to work in? I was like, I don't know. Like, he's like, you like guns? I'm like, well, yeah. And he's like, well, work in ordnance. I'm like, oh, that'd be great. No, it was the worst, department ever. But anyways, I was able to get into the, you know, the armory and stuff. And I just took my friggin' weapons box home with my nods in it and everything. And on leave, I drove home, and we went out to my buddy's farm. We had this like whole paintball field set up. Like we had a paintball van. We had this 87 Chevy Astro van that had like a turret in it and tires on the front. And we used it for like motorcade paintball operations and stuff. But anyways, we went out there. It was like 10 of us. And I told them it was starting to get dark and guys wanted to build a fire and eat and hang out. And I was like, hey, you guys want to have a paintball game? And they're like, a night one? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, fine. I'm like, how about me versus all of you? And they're like, oh yeah, you know, you're Navy SEAL. You think you can take us? I'm like, yeah, how about it? And they're like, fine. Well, I had stashed my Mitch helmet with my nods, my PBS-15s out in the woods. And then I gave them IR chem lights. And I'd already,
nice.
But I'd already cracked them. And I said, hey guys, if you get shot, you know, tie this IR chem light on your camouflage top or whatever they're wearing, and then crack it. It's their blue chem lights. And then, you know, you're out. And they're like, oh, okay. Well, I go out there and I said, fine, about 10 minutes, come get me. I go out there, put my nods on, and they're patrolling out there. And it's just, you know, IR chem light. And it was a pretty luminous night too, as well. And I'm just wasting them, and they're shooting in all directions. And it was like Predator, like shooting in all directions type thing. And they're screaming, and I'm just wasting them. And I'm moving from like bush to bush to bush. And they're like, they all get wasted. You know, I smoke them all. They go back to the campfire, and they're like screaming, like, we're done playing, blah, blah, blah. And I walked out of the woods, and I should have just walked out just slick, like not with my stuff on, and just said, what's up guys? Like, you didn't know my skills. But I walked out with the nods down, and they freaked out. And then the rest of the night, we ended up driving this 87 Chevy Astro van around the farm until we actually blew the engine and ran it into a ditch. But yeah. So.
Well, in all estimations, it sounds like you had a great childhood, got you slated towards the right path. I do want to ask about something though. You join in 2001. I think you're in boot camp when 9/11 happens.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So you already know what you want to do. You know you want to be a Navy SEAL. You know you want to do these things. Is it a different feeling for you? Are you just like super pumped that this happened and you're like, wow, this is really going to be what I wanted to do my whole life? Does it get more real for you? Does it get surreal for you? What are you feeling when you see all of this happen and you know what's getting ready to happen on the backside of it?
Well, so it was a little weird having 9/11 happen in boot camp because, you know, it wasn't like we had access to just go hang out and watch TV. So at first there was like Rumorville, you know, you hear something from some other boot camp division or whatever, and then there's rumors starting, and that's kind of how it was at first. And then it was like crazy rumors, and it got to the point where like the RDC had to basically bring us in to, you know, and show us Fox News or whatever news station we were watching to actually give us like, hey, here's exactly what's happening. But at first, like, I don't know, it didn't like 100% register for me at first in boot camp, like, hey, this is going to change my experience in the military. You know, because I wasn't thinking that many layers deep. I was just thinking, you know, pass boot camp, pass my SEAL PRT, get a BUDS contract, and go to BUDS. It really wasn't until I got to BUDS to where, you know, the instructors are like screaming at us, telling us like, you're going to war now, like this is real, to where I was like, oh, this means that something's going to change. Because again, I, watching all those movies, you know, like the Charlie Sheen movie, I thought that it was like, you know, team guys jumping out of hay hoeing out of airplanes, doing secret stuff all the time, all over the world. And it's not like that at all. And so I didn't think that like 9/11 was going to like change the entire, basically not only the tactics in the teams, but also just the whole flavor of the SEAL teams themselves with the wars. Cause I thought that team guys were out there running and gunning all the time, but they weren't.
So what is it like when you find out that, because that's kind of definitely a blow whenever you look and you go, whoa, now it's what I thought it was going to be. But before that it wasn't. So let's play devil's advocate, and you walk into that where it is the old way. How do you think your career turns out?
Like how it is, like if it was the like workout.
You know how you said, you know, that you thought it was like the movie when you came in, that you're just doing missions all the time, and it wasn't like that. Now it's changing, and it's going to be 20 years of sustained combat and stuff. But let's say none of that happened. Does it change your career at all? I mean, knowing what you know and the minutia in the teams and all of that, does it change your career, you think?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there wasn't, like, when I showed up to Team 2, none of those older guys had ever fired their weapons in combat. Like, you know, Team 2 was, before 9/11, was they were the winter warfare team. So they would go up to Norway and they would train with the Jaegers and do winter warfare training and all that. But yes, without 9/11 or you know, GWAT, pretty much, it would have been a completely different experience. Even if, like, let's say we went over to development group or something like that, where you think, okay, well, now they're really going to start doing stuff. Even they weren't doing hardly nothing, like, as far as assaults and combat on a regular basis at all. Like, maybe tiny little things here and there, but really nothing, man.
So I guess the way I'm trying to form the question to you is, do you think it changes your mind state about your career? Do you think you have the longevity? Because, and the reason I ask that is not necessarily because of the combat time, but with you knowing all the minutia that goes into downtime and training cycles and all that kind of stuff, do you think it would change your career in your mind that you might not be around as long as you did?
Yes, possibly. And you know, this is, you know, talking about like guys not being in combat before 9/11, like that is not to take away anything from like team guys pre 9/11.
Absolutely.
And their service. Cause here's the thing, every team guy, even pre 9/11, if they had a chance to go to the wars, they would have done perfectly, and they would have performed, and they would have put out, and they would have done the same job that all the rest of us did. But a lot of guys, you know, they got in the teams pre 9/11, you know, I know a few of them, and it wasn't what they thought it was going to be. So a lot of them didn't stick around as long, you know, because deployments were just J sets where you're just going training some other, you know, like with the Jaegers, or going to South America for Team 4 and training, you know, some indigenous guys down there and so forth. And so some guys didn't probably do as long of careers. I mean, there's a few guys that got out and then like 9/11 happened and they were like, oh crap, I'm going to go back in because, you know, now I actually might get to go to war. And quite a few of them did that. I mean, some of them even had to go back through SEAL qualification training, which was like a four and a half month thing after BUDS that you had to do before you actually got your Trident. But some of them, yeah, they went, like 9/11 happened and they went back in, you know? So
did you see differences in, because you're there at the very beginning of all this, I mean, you're in, of course, boot camp, but pretty close to the 9/11, you're going into combat. Did you see a change in all the years that you were there in the tactics and the procedures and how things were handled and how people handled the situations?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm a big CQB guy. You know, I taught it at our assault cell for, you know, about a year and a half before I got out. And when I first came in, the CQB, actually, you know, it's funny you mentioned the Navy SEALs thing. So in my CQC classes, you know, with the law enforcement guys, I just trained a SWAT team a week ago, but I have the clip where they're all busting in through the door, guys coming in through the ceiling, and like they're all online and they're just
so fantastic.
In. Oh, I know. I mean, flying in through the ceiling. I mean, I wish I would have been able to do that in the teams, but I didn't. But I did fall through a roof in Fallujah, but that was not part of the operation.
It's only part of the operation if you tell people it was part of the operation. Wow.
I was on top of a roof and it was weak and I went through and I fell down and I went down to the living room and the guys were down there and I ended up down there and they're like, how'd you get down here? And I'm like, I just fell through the roof. That was not, you know, my choice, but I show that clip and then I transition that clip into, you know, talking about the difference between, you know, deliberate CQC, which is slow, methodical and calculated using distance and angles and cover and concealment, versus a hostage rescue dynamic approach. Because when I first came in the teams, that's all we did was dynamic. I mean, you know, you're down at Shaw's and at Mid-South Institute where we did all our assault training and, you know, instructors are screaming at you, you know, throwing water bottles in the rafters, get in there. And you're running on with your hair on fire. And you know, it just, that came to a screeching halt when enough guys started rotating overseas and getting shot at by hardened opposition and basically questioning and saying like, hey, why are we doing this? Like, why are we running into these rooms with our hair on fire? Like, when we don't have to. Now, if somebody's being hurt, if it's hostage rescue, like, that is, you know, what you're doing. But if it's not hostage rescue, like, why are we doing this? And that changed fundamentally across the board. I mean, our land warfare tactics changed. I mean, some of these tactics, DJ, were like, especially land warfare, some of the stuff was like Vietnam era tactics. And it just, the tactics weren't allowed to be challenged to know whether they actually work without being tested by dudes that wanted to throw down, you know, and getting lead slung at you. And then you start learning things and realizing what works and what doesn't work and so forth. So,
when did you realize in combat that some of the stuff wasn't working? Was there an aha moment for you?
I would say, my first real combat deployment in 05 in Baghdad, we were still doing the hostage rescue style CQB for the most part. You know, we didn't start doing the deliberate style. I want to say 06, 07 ish. You know, I can't really give a specific instance other than you're going on these assaults and stuff and it feels out of control. Like you don't know where guys are. You're coming in on each other. And here's the thing, like if guys are shooting on targets, I mean, and you know this full well in the law enforcement world, and with dynamic entrances, you have to, the deconfliction isn't controlled, right? Because you're making dynamic entrances. Like in a deliberate style world, you can make deconflictions, like, which basically means two elements are coming into the same space, and you can have it be a lot more controlled. You can set up chem lights, you can use IR lasers, and you can hold off, you know, one element is the receiving element and one pushes to that element. But with HR, you're just flying in on each other. And, you know, we one of our guys in our platoon got shot. We were doing HR in training and, you know, a guy shot him because it was all dynamic and it's uncontrolled. And so like, if you're overseas on a target and, you know, things are not going well and it's a bad target, like it's just really sketchy running in with guns, pointing guns at your buddies. I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, yeah, don't shoot your buddy, but it's like, you're amped up, you know what I mean? And there's a huge potential for fratricide, you know, in those situations.
Let's talk about the first time you're in combat, the first time you're a SEAL, you've done all this training, you've done everything to get to this point.
Yeah.
You're in the game now. Do you remember how you felt?
I felt like, I felt great. Like I felt like I was like doing what I had always wanted to do my whole life. You know, even like the initial, just like a patrol into a target, like I felt kind of dorky in the sense, because like I was doing that in high school, you know what I mean? Like in the dorky way, but now I'm doing it for real. And I was like, this is so cool. Like I'm doing this for real. And you know, it dawned on me that this is like real, real, like we could actually get shot at, but it was fun for me. Like I enjoyed every minute of the teams.
How is home life and everything as you're doing this, you're doing all these train ups, you know, your wife was in on this very early with you, but it's a different world when you start training up, you start being gone all the time, you start deploying. How's everything with that working out as a family?
So she had a super strong support network. One of my good buddies that has actually, you know, he's been over at development group since 06. He's still over there as a master chief, but his wife and my wife and another guy that actually retired out of Gold Squadron were like best friends. And so all the three of us were in a platoon together. And then the three of them, I mean, they ended up like basically like sleeping over at each other's houses all the time. They all were having kids at the same time. And so it was perfect for them, you know, to it was almost like they enjoyed us being gone. I mean, I shouldn't say that, but they did. I mean, it was like,
there's like a, at least they're not saying that the good Lord may take you. We can.
No, I don't think my wife went that far.
Okay.
But like, I remember like, there's like a 6-year stretch where I hadn't been home for more than a month. And it's almost like, I don't know. It's like, we could have done a lot more training locally, like in Virginia Beach, but it's like every trip was like 5 weeks at Chaffee, you know, 2 weeks at Mid-South, 2 weeks at Fort Knox, like 3 weeks out in Nevada mobility. Like, you'd go on this workup where it was like, you're gone for 3 weeks, home for a week, gone for a month, home for a week, maybe home for 2 weeks, maybe, and then gone for 5 weeks. And then you deploy. I mean, I was never home, but like, I remember I was home for like 3 weeks straight or something like that in the middle of that time period. And my wife was like, hey, when are you going on your next trip? And I'm like, why? And she's like, well, you're like messing up my routine. Because it's my wife and the two friends, they were, you know, homemakers, and they were just spending our money and having sleepovers and watching movies and having girls' nights. And they thought it was great. And it was, you know, it was taxing. It was more, I think it was more taxing when like my daughters, you know, I have a 16-year-old daughter and a 15-year-old daughter, but when they started to get older a little bit, it was harder, you know. I mean, that's one of the reasons I got out of the teams, was because I wanted to just, not that like team guys that do a career, you know, aren't awesome fathers and you know, and invest in their kids, but I wanted to have a little more time to be the dad, you know, a dad that's around. And, you know, like my dad, he was always taking us and doing stuff with us. And so I wanted to do that. And it was right in about 2010. And it was also when Obama took over, which everything went to crap, you know, not only just ROEs overseas, but our funding. I mean, it was like a mass exodus in the teams when Obama got it, right around 2010-ish. So I just decided, you know, this is kind of a time for me to move on and do other things.
Let's talk about a couple things there that you bring that up. I want to talk about 2010, how it starts changing things for the teams, how it starts changing things for the military in general. But I want to go back to a point that you said real quick about, you know, you're not saying that SEALs aren't awesome fathers and stuff like that. But I think what should be pointed out in law enforcement, first responders, all that kind of stuff, I don't think it's intentionally bad fathers, even when it happens. I think that sometimes it just gets in the way. I've asked a lot of guys, why do this? Why be deployed all the time? Why do that? And they say it's easier, and that's, you know, just ingrained to them in what they're doing. So I want to point that out, that I don't think people do that on purpose. I don't think that there's bad fathers out there. I'm not saying that there's not here and there something like that, but I think in general, people are trying to do the job and be the person who they think they should be. And I think you would agree with that, right?
Oh yeah. No, they're trying to do the best they can. And when they're home, they're investing in their kids. But, you know, at the end of the day, especially with like young boys, you know, in the teams, you know, with guys and sons, it's hard to be that father figure there for them. Like, you know, on a regular basis, like my one buddy who came back from deployment, and his kid was, I forget how old he was, like, you know, and he comes home and his son's peeing, sitting down, you know, and he's like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm going to the bathroom. And he's like, why aren't you standing up? He's like, but this is how mommy goes to the bathroom, you know. But you're just around, you know, the mother all the time. And, you know, it just, but a lot of, you know, a lot of team guys will take, you know, there's opportunities to take different various billets where you can take a little break, you know, and you can, you know, whether you're an instructor or whatever it might be. Like my buddy Nick Miller that works for my company, you know, he took a 2-year billet, which allowed him to actually be home for his family all the time, you know, because he did 23 years in the West Coast teams. It gets to a point where it's just you get burnt out, and you gotta kind of take a sometimes a billet or something that provides a little bit of, you know, time to reset.
And I think that's a big thing that a lot of guys don't think about. And I think they do reach burnout. And I'm speaking from a law enforcement point of view. Oh, yeah. I was in the military, but it's different. And I speak longer from being in law enforcement, longer than in the military. You just reach a burnout, and it affects everything around you. It affects family. It affects your job performance and all that kind of stuff. And I wish I could see more people go, you know what, maybe it's time to take a knee for a while, do something else, relax a little bit, kind of reset that clock, and then get back at it.
Yeah.
But I think the same thing that you said, it's hard to do for a lot of people.
Yeah. It's hard for guys to take billets to where, you know, I mean, I know there was like some BUDS instructors when I was in BUDS that like, they were at like 9/11 happened. They were at BUDS like in 9/11. Right. And so they were still a BUDS instructor, but they felt like they were like not, like, I got to get out and be with the boys in combat. Like, I'm, I don't want to be at this, even though you need good buds instructors to put good students through. They didn't want to be, you know, at a buds billet when they could be out there slinging lead next to their brother. It's hard to, and guys just, unfortunately, a lot of team guys end up burning both ends of the candle. And I think the divorce rate is like, literally like 97% in the SEAL teams. You know, I'm pretty sure it's pretty high in law enforcement, but it is like, I thought I read some study or something about divorce rate in the military, and it was like the SEAL teams was the highest. I mean, one of my platoon chiefs like was on his fifth wife, and I was just,
I've seen it.
Yeah. I'm like, at what point, like, do you stop marrying, bud? You know, I don't know, but you know, it's just what it is.
I've got a guy that I think he's on his fourth or fifth wife, and he's done 50 years, like in law enforcement, 50 years. Yeah. He's on his fifth wife. I'm like, at what point do you go, I'm probably not good at this. Maybe I should just, maybe I should stop giving part of my retirement away and just be alone.
Yeah. Like, I don't even know how they have any more money left to give or whatever, alimony or whatever. I don't know.
But, you know, I had a buddy though. He was military, law enforcement. He worked in certain jobs with me, and it came time, and they were going to give him a job where he could be at a desk for a while. His son was getting ready to graduate from high school, and him and I were talking about it, and he was like, yeah, man, but people will say stuff about me if I take this job. And I was like, who gives a shit? Like, yeah. They're not paying your house payment and stuff. Like, who cares if it gives you time to do this? But you see that really start affecting people, and they're like, man, I just don't know if I can do that and stuff. And I'm like, man, you – you're going to have to take a break, because it's going to come one way or the other.
Yeah. At some point, it's like, you know, one of my platoon chiefs, like, the problem is these guys, they don't want to grow up. A lot of them, you know, like my one platoon chief was like, I don't know how many platoons. And I'm like, you know, what makes you stay in the teams this long? He's like, 'cause I don't have to grow up, you know. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, is it, you know, sometimes is it worth, like, you know, losing all your family over? And, you know, it's hard, man. 'Cause it is not a, you know, just that, like I said, like, you could do a lot more training. And I think, speaking of, I only have a few buddies that are still in, they do a lot more local training. But when I was in, there was like, nothing was local, and it was all on these trips all over the place. And it's like, guys just like almost seemed like they wanted to be, you know, out there away from their wives or whatever. But it's just,
is that Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, that you said you went? Yeah. What an armpit, man. That place is horrible.
Oh, I know. It's a five week trip, but there's some good hunting on Chaffee, that's for sure. I got it good with the DNR guy there, and I hooked his gun up with a bunch of stuff. He let me and my buddies go out there. I'm like, he gave me a key to the part of the base, and we just went out there and hunted hogs. And shot our, I mean, we were out just driving our trucks and ATVs back there, and we were just shooting all the sniper weapons with, you know, the Night Force scopes and all that. And we were just slaying stuff.
Let's talk about something that I think is important to you, but I want to know about in your past. Now, you said your parents were both, you know, church people. Your dad said that it was God's way of them marrying and all that kind of stuff. I want to talk about your faith back then and your faith that you have now. And I want to know, after everything that you've seen, everything you've been in, I know that your faith had to have changed a little bit, whether it's the perspective you look at it or something, but it had to have changed over what? So let's talk about faith when you were younger and how you felt about it as you kind of moved through your career. And now that you're done with that career and you've moved on to this second chapter, what your faith is now?
Well, I mean, you know, growing up in a you know, strong Christian home, you kind of just follow lead of your parents, and you don't really own it yourself. You know, you go to church and you check all the boxes and you do all that. But there, you know, there's a point when you leave the parents' home to where now your faith is going to be tested as to whether, you know, it's real for you. And, you know, I found that mine was lacking big time, you know, hugely. And, you know, the team community kind of sucked me away from it, not away from it, but, you know, into some lifestyle stuff that was not obviously anything that would be biblically correct. And it wasn't until my Fallujah deployment in 06-07 that I really changed, you know, spiritually. Like, I owned it myself. I actually, you know, started practicing what
the scriptures teach, you know, as far as, you know, Christian behavior and what a Christian is. And I left that deployment completely changed, basically. Completely changed, kind of brought that home to my family, my children. And, you know, since that deployment, it's just been a trajectory of, you know, I run a home church in my house. It's small. It's not like some big church. I'm not a big fan of the institutional churches or like the denominational churches, because so many of them are like just Ned Flanders and, you know, Oakley Doakley, bless you, brother. And it's so fake and it's just so empty. And like, you know, you go and you check a box and you listen to some, you know, basically like a rock show, you know, for an hour and then that's it. And I'm much more, you know, part of my, like I told you, my, steroid extrovertness. I like interaction. Like I like to have real relationships, you know, like all the people in our home church are, you know, close friends. We do stuff with each other outside of the church. You know, when I read the book of Acts, it's very much communal, you know, type of Christian living where you're invested in each other's lives. You know, each other, you know, a lot of people don't want to, you know, get invested in that because then they see weaknesses, you know, or they see faults and they just put up this fake, you know, like the person you walk into the church and they just got this makeup on and they're just fake and they act fake. And I hate fake. And so I just wanted to have more. I do. I just have a more of a real relationship thing where we have discussion over the Bible. We actually, you know, debate stuff, you know, in my tactics classes and my CQB classes. Like I tell law enforcement guys, I say, hey man, if you think there's a better way to do this, you tell me, like debate me about it, you know, let's debate about it and talk about it and hash it out and see what works and what doesn't work. And that's, I kind of approach the Bible like a team guy. And I like to debate scriptures and have different views and someone, hey, what do you think about this? And we, it's more of a, I mean, I facilitate the teachings like each week, but like, it's more of a discussion to where everyone's, you know, engaging and talking together and learning together. So, you know, and we're very much, you know, very close. And if something happens to somebody, we're all affected and we all support each other and help each other out in any way that we can. So
would you say religion is messy?
Yeah, I would say the number one reason that people, you know, hate religion is because of hypocrisy. I mean, you know, because they have a bad experience when they grow up, or they were mistreated by someone calling themselves a Christian, you know. But the problem is, at the end of the day, it's like, you can't judge, you know, Christianity by people and in their behavior. Like, you have to look to the person that, you know, is the center of Christianity, which is Jesus of Nazareth, and look at what he taught and his behavior, and not confuse that with some jerk that, you know, mistreats you at a church or mistreats you, you know, in some way at some Bible study group or whatever it might be, and confuse that with, you know, the actual faith and what Jesus and the apostles taught and the Old Testament prophets.
When you're in combat and you see the horrors that are happening, I can look at it in law enforcement and see the things that I've seen over the years. Do you ever look at it and go, how can all this happen? How can this happen to people when you see horrible monsters of people live and make it through things, and then you see someone who's completely innocent or whatever? Does that ever, or did it ever test your faith?
Yeah, that's actually a great question, DJ. You know, I don't want to get like, I mean, I love theology and I could literally speak for the next hour, you know, and take you line by line with stuff. But like, you know, the long and short of it is that when we look at this creation right now in the age that we live in, what it was in the beginning in the, you know, because I believe that the Genesis is a historical narrative. You know, I don't believe in the sophisticated pond scum view and that we went from the goo to the zoo to you. I don't believe in that worldview. I think that's, you know, a fairy tale. I do believe that Genesis is historical narrative and history. So everything was perfect at the beginning, everything perfect. Man was perfect in living in Iraq, in the Garden of Eden, having access to immortality, tree of life. Sin came in, man made his choice. God didn't cause him to do it at all. And we got separated from that environment. And what we see now is the product of a cursed environment, of man's own demise, and we've screwed stuff up. And, you know, it's very hard to, especially the stuff that I've seen overseas,
to see a loving God, you know, that loves mankind in that. But again, we're not looking at it from God's original purpose when he called it all good. We're looking at it from a fallen perspective. But, you know, the message of the Bible as a whole is that someday God's restoring it all back to the original. And it's all justice, like complete justice is going to be had. And that's what's the greatest message about the Bible is from front to back is God restoring, you know, God's in the restoration business. He's going to fix it all. You know, none of these wicked dudes that, you know, we saw stuff overseas that was just horrible. None of these guys are getting away with anything because the Jewish man from Nazareth, like one of my favorite songs is a Johnny Cash song, When the Man Comes Around, because when the man comes around and he splits the sky open, justice is going to be had. I mean, Revelation 19, Isaiah 63, you know, talks about, you know, basically God coming back and vengeance. I mean, to the point where there's blood splattered on his clothes because he's going to combat with the wicked. And that's the message of the Bible is that it's all being restored and it's all going to go back to what it was in the beginning. And it's, but in the interim, it's hard to see that hope or even to like tell their people about that hope because all the experience, especially people that have, I mean, I had a great childhood. You know, but people that have jaded childhoods or just stuff that's just horrible stuff that happened to them, it's very easily to confuse that experience with God causing it or you know, God wanting it to happen. Like he doesn't want it to happen. Like there's a story in the Gospels where there's these towers that fell and these Jews are asking Jesus like, hey, were they more evil than people that it killed, you know? Were they more evil and that's why they died? And Jesus basically said, like, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but he said, no, towers fall, unfortunately, but it's not that God's causing it at all, and he's going to fix it all eventually. But it's very difficult to see God in this environment when we look at how jacked up it is, especially when you're in my line of work.
And let me ask you something, because I ask you, was there a point where you saw, hey, the training needs to change and stuff like that? Was there something that happened that changed? Where you, because you said it wasn't until, I guess that was your last deployment, Fallujah, where you changed and thought, man, I need to go down a different route. Was there something that happened there that did that?
I mean, there was a few ops that were pretty hairy. I'm not going to say it was like something that was like life, you know what I mean? Like a specific op that I can say, this is when I decided I need to get, make sure I'm actually doing what God, you know, like getting right with God and doing what I should be doing. I'm not going to say there was that specific time, but you know, I had brought my Bible with me on every trip, but it just collected dust. But that deployment, I decided to actually start reading it. And that's what, you know, started to change my trajectory of my faith, you know, going forward. So,
and the reason that question comes up is because, you know, it seems like such a difference. It seems like such a turn when it never really was an important thing. You've done these combat tours, you've done all this stuff. And then in your final one, that's when everything changes over and you take it forward for the rest of your life. So, you know, when you hear that, it seems hard, I think, for people to grasp like, okay, well, something had to change, something in you, something, you know, whatever.
You know, yeah, I could like, you know, kind of exaggerate a little bit and, you know, basically connect it with one op that I went on and make it, you know, that type of thing. But it really wasn't. It was just that I started picking up my Bible and reading more. And then that started to make me like reflect on like, hey, what am I actually, is this actually like real to me? Or is this just a religious thing that I grew up in, you know, and kind of just followed in the footsteps of my parents?
Let's talk about kind of a lighter subject. Let's talk about your skin tone and things that you had to do with sunblock and, you know, with someone of your skin tone, because it's a very light skin tone, we've darkened you up a lot for this video.
Good. I hope you can like put a filter over my skin somehow. Yeah.
So when you're in the middle of a desert and the sun is beating down and it's 1,000 degrees out there, how do you look at life with that skin tone?
Well, I could get burnt by the moon probably. But I just had to cover myself all the time. I mean, it's all the time covered. I mean, you know, these dudes would like, you know, the darker guys in the team, they'd be up there, on top of like the hooches that we were staying in, like tanning, you know what I mean? Like in that Iraq heat, if I went up there and tanned, I would die. Like I would legitimately, no, I'm not kidding. Like I'd be hospitalized. Like DJ, my biggest fear when I went to Buds was not like any of the Buds training or the stuff that I would have to do in Buds. My biggest fear was like, are they going to let me put sunblock on, you know, during training? Because I'd seen all the videos there at the pool in those little tight little UDT shorts. And I was like, if I'm at the pool in that San Diego heat all day without sunblock, I'll be hospitalized. Like I'll be burnt that bad. But they let me put it on. In fact, when we got to the pool, there was like this ceremony that would happen every time, not every time, but majority of time, where they would be like, Wallach, you pasty beepity beep, get in front and center. And I'd stand there and then they would make another student put sunblock on me. And it was like that zinc oxide, like that super thick stuff. You know? Like it wasn't like,
it's copper, almost like a paste.
Yeah. It wasn't like copper tone, like spray, you know, or just go right in. It was like, it was literally like, I look like, you know, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, and they'd make him rub it on me. And then they'd make him do it like sensually, like rub me sensually, you know, and just for their own pleasure. You know, they'd be like, rub him more. And, you know, but I don't know if you've like a guy putting another sunblock on another guy. It's like, you know, if a dude's like, hey, put some sunblock on my back, they'll like put it on their hand and they'll just like swipe their hand, you know, down. And so like the first,
that's just not a good friend. Okay. Let's just point that out. That's not a good friend.
But the first time a guy put it on me, I was like, hey man, put some sunblock on me. And he does that. And like, so the center of my back where this hand was fine, but the rest of my back was like fried, like peeled, you know, but yeah, it sucked. It wasn't great. So.
And you're in the water 5-6 hours a day and you get bad sunburn in water. And people don't think that. They think if you're in the water, you're good, but you burn even faster.
It intensifies it. I mean, it makes it even worse. Like, I mean, now that zinc oxide stuff, it stayed on better than like, you know, the copper tone stuff that I use now. At least it helped me a little bit, but that's why I never carried like a VS17 panel. I just would take my shirt off and just go like this, you know, if the helos were coming in or whatever, and we'd be fine. So,
well, with your size and skin tone, I think you would have been just fine.
Yeah.
Can we talk about your time as a sniper?
I never went through sniper school.
Rephrase the question in sniper teams.
Yeah. So I went through pick school, which was just like the cameras, but I never ended up getting, I wanted to go to scout sniper, which was in Atterbury in Indiana, but I think I just had my daughter at the time or something. It was some kid thing. And I didn't want to, cause we had like this 3.5-4 month period after deployment called Pro Dev where we could go to schools, you know, and stuff. And, you know, it was just and that sniper school was super long, and basically I would have been gone even more and I didn't end up taking it. But 05 deployment, we did some sniper work where you didn't have to be snipers. And so basically what we would do is we would solicit different bases and be like, hey, where are you having the worst IED concentration problem? And then they would tell us, and then we would go do a route recce sometimes, you know, if it was like in the urban area, we look at buildings we can set up in, and we would just take like either 2-man teams if it was rural or 4-man teams. And we would just go into different buildings and we would watch stuff. You know, now we did have a few snipers in the platoon. But you know, some of us had saws, like I carried the saw a few times, and then, we would set up, you know, on different roads. Like we worked this one road in Taji, Iraq called Route Chargers. I think it was the Marines were coming down their army convoys or whatever, but they were getting ate up, you know, bad, like, you know, with IEDs. And the reason why is because the road was very close to, it was a rural area. So all this tall grass and stuff. So these jerks could hide in the grass, you know, and set it off, you know, they didn't even have to use a cell phone. They could just have, you know, set it off with a detonator, you know, attached to the line attached to the explosive and just set it off, you know, hiding behind the brush and all that. But we took our whole platoon of about, I think it was like 15 dudes in pairs, and we just stretched out
over this like 3 mile, 4 mile stretch of the road, like to put dudes like every, you know, half mile or, you know, or about every half mile. And then we just stay out there for 40 hours and watch. And we actually, our platoon killed a lot of guys at deployment just doing that, you know, in the city and in a rural area. In fact, the first time that I actually engaged another human and took the breath of life from them was in one of those hides. Me and my good buddy that's, you know, I mentioned before, he's still over at development group. He's a master chief over there. But we were sitting in this, you know, in this little hide. We kind of got a little bit over the top with face paint, you know, and ghillie suits. Now, some of the ghillie suits like were perfect to the environment along that route, Chargers, and because it was rural, it was actually, you know, you'd want to wear a ghillie suit. But you know, we were getting a little over top with face paint just because we could, you know, and we all loved the whole men with green faces thing, and so we were painting our faces just for fun sometimes, just to act like we were friggin' Vietnam, you know, team guys. But yeah, him and I are sitting on this in this sniper hide at watching this part of the road. I mean, we're only like maybe 50 yards from the road, and we're watching, and we've been out there, I can't remember, quite a while, baking in the sun, not, you know, nothing, like no sound. Maybe once in a while, a civilian Iraqi car would go by like every 4 hours or something, you know, but there'd be convoys that would go by, but basically nothing. And you're just out there, nothing. And all of a sudden we hear a bunch of voices, and my buddy and I were taking turns watching. And then like, I'd be, you know, kind of taking a break and looking behind us, and he'd be watching the road. And he was the one that was at the moment was actually watching the road. And these five dudes, you know, come out from the brush, literally like 25 yards from us. They're walking up to the road carrying 80 millimeter shells, AKs with shovels. And they're just acting like they're in their backyard, just coking and joking and hanging out. And it was weird because there was no sound or anything. And then all of a sudden people talking, and I didn't know what was going on. And I kind of, you know, looked over to me, and I shouldn't say his name, but he looked over me.
I can block it out. Don't worry about it. I'll block it.
Yeah. All right. He looked over at me, and he doesn't even say anything, because I was like about to be like, hey, what's going on? He just looks at me and goes, hey, we're shooting these guys. And I'm like, okay. And we both kind of stand up a little bit, you know, out of the brush, and we just start engaging them. And it was like 25 yards away, we start shooting these guys, all five of them. And they ran, because of the suppressors, they didn't know what was coming from. They ran right towards us. I mean, right towards us. And yeah. And like, you know, it's not like the movies where they just fly apart and they fly backwards, and they were still running. Like I was shooting, I thought I was missing, you know, and I can't remember if it was green tip that we were using, or we started to use this 77 grain round, but green tip is horrible. I mean, for actually putting dudes down, because it's got that tungsten core and it just zips through you. It just doesn't do anything. Now, if you're shooting a dude behind a car, or a wall or something, it can be effective because it'll penetrate, you know, and get to them. But if you're just shooting flesh, it just, imagine just a 22 gauge needle, you know what I mean? Just zipping through with, so if you're not hitting them in the heart or the head, they're not going down right away. Especially they were young. They were probably like in their early 20s, and they're all hopped up, you know, and just they ran right towards us. And this is why hunting is so important for a lot of team guys, you know, grew up hunting. Or hunting is so important for transitioning into some real life scenario where you're going to actually, you know, take the breath of life from another human. Because for me, in that first time that I was actually shooting another person, that's what my brain went to. Like it went to like when I was a kid and I was shooting at a squirrel with a 22, and then I was chasing, you know, like I'm shooting at it and the squirrel's injured, and then I'm chasing the squirrel, you know, and all that. And so I started engaging these guys, and they started to go down. And then I ran up to them, because that's, I don't know why, just like muscle memory of what I did as a kid when I would shoot animals. And I ran up to them, and they're all right in front of me, like 5 yards, 7 yards in front of me, just rolling around. And I'm just like, I went through two mags, and my buddy came up too, you know, right behind me, but he was doing headshots. Like he was like, boom, boom, boom. Like I was just too excited, like, because I was like back as a kid, like shooting my 22 with banana clip, my 10-22, and you know, he was doing more calculated headshots. But you know, it was like, after we were done, we kind of looked at each other. We're like, oh, like that was interesting. But yeah, it was pretty interesting to say the least. But
did he talk to you about, hey, maybe be calculated next time? And
he was like, he's like, dude, you're, he said something like, you're trigger happy, bro. And or something like that.
But, did you tell him, no, I'm just happy?
Yeah, I was too excited, man. I was just like, this is like too exciting. So,
I want to ask something about a picture that you sent me.
It'll get me in trouble because I got a lot of those, but
right. We're gonna be kind of secretive about it. But you sent me a picture that is now a painting that is hanging somewhere that people can see it.
Yeah.
And I wonder what the story is behind it. Now, of course, I'll post the picture on your episode page. That's why you sent it to me. We're not gonna say who it involves because we're just not, but we'll put the picture up.
Come on. It's not like it's like, you know, secret.
Yeah, but I want people to look for it. I want people to work for it a little bit.
All right.
So there's a picture of it. Can you tell the story behind it and why you decided to do what you did in that picture?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's me, another guy, you know, and it's got Sean Ryan in it. And I'm grabbing Sean Ryan's rear end in the picture. We're in a sniper hide, but the picture captures the team's, like, you know, there's too many team guys out there that are like, you know, Billy Badass, you know, like just like, you know, always like serious and like always giving motivational speeches and always like, you know, they're John Wick or something like that, you know. And the team's like, the humor in the teams is hilarious. Like, guys are funny. We coke and joke. When you're sitting in a sniper hive for 48 hours, there is going to be some grab assery that's going on. I mean, there's going to be goofing around. There's a lot of goofing around that happens, but that's the real teams is like humor, man. I mean, like, just to give you an example, like when we engage these guys, I was a block down, so I just heard it over the radio, but some of the other guys engaged these guys, you know, same thing with these sniper hides. They engaged these guys in a car and the car went back and blew up this light post, and they both saw gunners like dumped a whole box of saw into the car with these dudes in it. But one of the things that came over the radio, I'm listening to it a block down, was like, I heard all this shooting. I heard the saws go off. I saw the sparks from the street lights that went off when the car hit it. And then there was this, all the shooting went, and then there was this slight little lull, and all I heard was Tits McGee over the radio. And it was one of the guys, that was his name in Halo. Like, we were dorks and we'd play Halo sometimes in the evenings, like when we were back from an op or if we didn't have an op. And his Halo name was Tits McGee. And every time he'd kill you in Halo, just to piss you off, he'd say Tits McGee, because everyone's got, you know, comms on the Halo game. And so, you know, he says it over the radio after they just shot dudes. But that's the kind of humor that like goes on in the teams. And I think that picture, you know, kind of captures that, where it's just like my one buddy to the left there is yawning. He's like, oh, and I'm grabbing, you know, the rear end, and, you know, I got the goofy look on my face, which, you know, the painting that Justin Hughes did of that, makes me slightly look a little bit, special, I think. Like, it makes me look a little odd, but yeah, it's, that's the type of stuff that really goes on in the teams. Not this, like, I'm not going to name any particular names out there, but some of these guys that make it look like what it's not.
Okay. So let's don't say any names, but let's talk about this. You and I talked before when we very first started talking about doing a show together, and we talked about painting the whole person, painting the whole picture, because there's so many people out there that are on the outside that look in and they think it's this way in the teams, or it's this way in law enforcement, or it's this way with first responders. And the whole point of this show is to give people an understanding. You and I have talked about this, yeah, of the whole person. So let's talk about that. Let's go a little deeper. You don't have to say any names, but I think we can definitely point some stuff out.
No, I mean, so,
you know, the team guys out there, and I don't need to say any names, but like team guys, some of them are doing stuff out there that is just so cheesy. I mean, so cheesy. I mean, it appeals to like the 40-year-old virgin, you know, in his parents' mom's basement that plays video games. But unfortunately, they use that because they know there's a target audience for these types of people that will eat up whatever they say. I mean, you put Navy SEAL on anything, YouTube video, million hits. You know, just say Navy SEAL. And it gives us a, you know, there's no shortage of these guys out there, you know, making a buck off the Trident, you know, just to sell tacky stuff, you know, like selling action figures of themselves, selling every goofy, tacky thing under the sun, or like literally they're like taking their morning dump in the morning and they're giving a motivational speech for the day, you know. And it just gets to a point where it's like, man, what happened to like a little bit more like, you know, I mean, at this point, the quiet professional thing, like at least when I went to teams, it wasn't as sensationalized as it is now. Like, you know, everyone knew about the SEAL teams, but I didn't go in the SEAL teams because I wanted to write a book when I get out. Not saying that if you write a book, you're, you know, a bad team guy or anything like that, but I didn't go in like thinking, you know, I'm going to make a buck off this, where some guys, like some of my buddies that are still in, said like some of the later generation guys that came in after me, like just got in, punched their time card, and then went out and wrote books and you know, did the whole Hollywood thing. And it's unfortunate because people think that it is something that it's not. And I'm going to tell you, DJ, there are no John Wicks. There are no Jason Bournes. Like, no one exists like an operator like that. They don't exist. Like, I took my wife on a date night the other night to watch The Beekeeper with Jason Statham.
How was that? Because I really want to see that.
I mean, it's an awesome movie, but no one like that exists on the earth.
Right.
Like, even these CIA, you know, people that I worked with, like, total, I mean, one of them was so overweight, he couldn't even get in the up-armored Mercedes.
I think you told me about that before.
Yeah, I mean, just pathetic, man. And nobody exists like that. Nobody. I mean, you know, I know I have, you know, close friends that, you know, were people that I know that were on the UBL raid. And like some of these guys you'd meet in a bar, you would never be able to know. You would never know. Like, they just look like an average dude. You know, I mean, one of, you know, just like an insurance agent. The thing is like none of them are at the level of any of these Hollywood movie people. You know, what they are is they're good shooters, right? We're good shooters. We'll put out, you know, we're in shape, and we'll go do a job that no one else wants to do at the end of the day. But we're not, you know, we're not like what it makes it out to be in the movies. And when you have an audience that thinks that, you can pretty much say whatever you want, you know what I mean? And you can give these motivational speeches and turn everything into like some sort of like, you know, gripping speech to motivate, you know, your audience. And yeah, you're going to get a million likes, you're going to get a million followers, but there's a point in the teams where, and I don't speak for every team guy, but at least guys that are buddies with me, where you reach, if you go too far with it, it becomes to where it's a turnoff, you know, to the community, where it's just, you know, if you're doing good things with it, you're putting out a good message. But then there's that cusp where you cross over to where now you're just trying to make money and a buck, and it's tacky, if that makes sense.
No, I think it does. And the question that I would have for you is, okay, let's start with the first one. Does that make it difficult for people? Let's use you for an example. When you came in, you'd seen Predator and all that, and we can joke about all that, but you had an idea of what you wanted to do. Yes, you saw those movies. Yes, all those things. But when people see this all the time, do you think it makes it more difficult when they get in and it's not necessarily what they're hearing?
Oh, yeah. No, when I got in, like, I thought I was going to have a, you know, I was going to graduate buds and I was going to have a beeper and be, you know, hey-hoing out of an airplane the next day. And, you know, like, literally the majority of buds, you don't learn anything. I mean, first phase, you could be a vanilla gorilla. You could be a snow chimp going through first phase and you'll make it through. Because as long as you can carry a log and you don't quit, you don't, you know, it's a no brainer. And then even when, like I said, even after you finish buds and SQT, you really don't know anything. And even before that first pump as a new guy, you don't know anything. And it's just, it's, it's just not, I mean, even like that GRS job I did, like just not what people think. I mean, you say CIA and it's like, oh my gosh, you know, Jason Bourne. No, not even close. Not even close.
So let's take it a step further. It is for when people are coming in and it's not the life that maybe they thought it was going to be. Do you think it's dangerous to the public in general to get that kind of message or to think, well, this is what they are, so this is what they have to be like. This is their personality. This is what they have to do in order to be good at their job or whatever. Do you see where I'm going with that?
Basically, you're saying if the perception's wrong, then people think that they need to meet that level is what you're kind of saying?
Meet that level, or where they think, you know, a guy like you jokes around and does all these things, fantastic career, all of those kind of things. But people will be like, well, I don't know, because I hear this guy telling me this and I think it should be like that because.
Okay.
That's being heard by more people. You understand what I'm saying now?
Yeah. Well, because, I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, like, you're going to make more money by sensationalizing things. You are, you know, because again, you're going to appeal to, you know, the beta dude that wants to do something hard in his life but never has. And then you start to motivate him and he just is, you know, it's kind of like these cult of personality pastors, you know, mega pastors that everyone's just sucked in and drawn to. Like it is, you can do that. I'm never going to do it. You will never have me, you know, my business and my company. I'm not going to be, you know, waking up in the morning, you know, brushing my teeth and giving you a motivational speech. I'm just, that's not what I'm about. Like I'm about a business that trains law enforcement and civilians and tactics. And, you know, I'm not going to be out there, you know, doing that type of thing. You know, are there some guys that do it to where it can help people? Yeah. But you know, in our community, it just gets to a point where it just gets, you know, I can name a certain names and like no one that I know that I respect would be like, oh yeah, he's a good dude. No, they'd be like, yeah, that guy, total tool. You know, it is that way with, you know, good team guys, they don't like it. You can make so much off the SEAL thing and we're not that cool really. I mean, we did some cool stuff, but we're not that high speed, man.
I think people would disagree, but let me ask you another question to that then. So how do we fix it? Or do we even fix it? Or do we just let it lie where it's at and let people decide for themselves? Or do we make an attempt to correct that thinking?
It's unfixable at this point. I mean, you're not going to, especially with social media and the way that, you know, 15, 20 years ago, this couldn't really even exist because we didn't have the technology to make it happen. You know, it's not going to be fixed, you know, but you know what I would, you know, what I would encourage like people that are drawn to like anything SEAL is to, you know, not to know that it's a lot more real than the Hollywood thing is. It's not real. All right. It's not Hollywood. It's the movies make it something that it totally not is. And just be careful with, you know, being sucked into, you know, somebody that's, you know, just going off on this and that to where, you know, you don't approach it in a real perspective. And, you know, I don't know, that would be my warning.
All right. Let's talk about something related to this, but a little to the side of it.
Okay.
When you're doing these contracts after you get out of the military.
Yeah.
And you're doing anti-piracy. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, but see, that's a perfect example of what we've just been talking about. Like, you know, you say anti-piracy, you know, APAS is the acronym for it, you know, operators for a company I work for called Tronic Group. And on the surface, that looks really cool, man. Like, right. Oh, you're going after pirates. Dude, you're rotting away on a container ship. Like sitting there on the bridge for hours on end, staring at the ocean with like no activity. And then maybe, you know, few things here and there, but it's just three, you know, I'd go out there with fly to Egypt and go down to Port Said and get on a ship with three other team guys. You know, what was hilarious about that contract when I first got on it in those early days was the company, all you had to do is send in your DD-214. And if you had 5326, like you'd get hired. Well, they realized after like a year or two that like, maybe we should have like a vetting course, like a shooting test. and a PT test, because like one of the first trips I did, there was a Vietnam dude on the trip with me, and we're on the back of the ship, and like we bust out the guns and we're sighting them in to make sure they're good to go. And like, I look over at him, I don't know how old he was, but this is a Vietnam guy. I mean, later in the, you know, towards the tail end, and he's like squinting, and I'm like, hey bro, like, do you see that target? And he's like, yeah, my eyes aren't very good. And I'm like, holy crap. Like, he could barely like carry his bag up the gangway to get on top of it. And I'm like, what is going on right now? And then they were like, man, we need to, you know, cause like you have like some team guy that was in like the early 90s, did 4 years, and then he's been an insurance agent, you know, since, and he hasn't been on the gun, and you're going to be expected for him to sling lead at pirate like dudes when they're attacking a boat. Like, so they came up with a vetting course and, you know, a way to be able to say, hey, these guys are, you know, capable to be, you know, operating a firearm in a dangerous situation.
Well, I think it's funny the way you talk about it. And that's what I think is so great about you. What I've always liked when we've talked on the phone and stuff is that you mention things and you're like, yeah, that's kind of stupid. It's people just don't know. And it's these moments of 5 minutes of action for 30, 40 hours of just sitting around waiting, or weeks at a time waiting. And I think that people don't understand that, and the boredom. The reason I bring that up is because when you look at law enforcement or first responders, there is downtime too. And a lot of guys, you know, like you said, are funny, are messing around. But I think we've reached this point, and it kind of relates back to the question that I asked you before. We've reached this point where these guys, these first responders, these law enforcement, these military, can't even mess around, can't screw around, because they're expected to be a certain thing 24 hours a day. And especially those 8 hours or 10 hours or however long they're working in front of the public.
Yeah.
And I think that we've reached a very critical mass point to where, we talked about it earlier, the burnout comes a lot faster because there's just no break. There's no breath being able to be taken.
Yeah. No, you got to have humor. I mean, like, even in Hell Week, like, it sucked, but like, if, you know, I had this one dude in my boat crew, I won't say his name, but like, he's still in the teams. And I mean, I'd look over at him, freezing your ass off in the surf zone, and he'd be like, ho-ho, buddy, you know, just like, and it's just like, yeah, like, it is just a game at the end of the day. Like, and you have to have that. You know, and I think you'd agree, like, I mean, these SWAT guys, these LaSalle guys I trained, like, great humor. Like, and you can tell the big difference between working with a team where they're all, I call it like the law enforcement stiffs, you know, like they're law enforcement through and through, like no change in, you know, in facial expression, no colorful at all, just, it's just business. And then, you know, you work with a team like these guys. Oh, it makes, I mean, because it was colder than crap, man. It was -8. My building has no heat. I had these blower heaters. It sucked. But because of that, they had humor, and it meshed well with my humor. It made that week 10 times more fun.
You know, and talking about it in just in general, I really would like to see that be more of something that people see. People see the other side of that uniform, whatever uniform that may be. And I think it's a good thing to point out that they're humans too. All of these guys are human. They have, now I will say the humor that you say, though, I will put a caveat on that and say that it's very dark humor.
Yeah. It's yeah. Some of the humor crosses the line of like, whoa, dude, like that is pretty messed up, you know, but you know, it's what I love about working with law enforcement is it's very much similar humor to the teams, and to where, like, you know, some dude at Office Max or civilian guy would never find that funny, like never.
Yeah.
Or would be like utterly shocked that you even said something like that, but
they'd be wrong. So, all right, let's talk about your training and stuff. Now, I saw that you were on another podcast where you talked about self-defense for women and stuff. I want to talk about kind of the state of security of the world right now and how people, I think, have kind of taken their eye off the ball about their own personal security or not really understanding everything that's lurking around them in the world. Can we talk about your thoughts on that and then how you incorporate that into your training?
Yeah, I mean, like, part of the thing is people just don't, again, I kind of, that other podcast, people live in these libtard bubbles where they do not understand reality. And they because we as a nation have been living in total cushness, if that's even a word, for so long, you know, like in World War II, like people, you know, or people that went through the Great Depression, or like, you know, everyone chipping in for the cause and everything. And times where this nation has been hard, you know, put through something hard, we haven't been for so long. People just don't, they don't really think that there's violent people out there that will kill you, will rape you. And they don't give a crap about it. They won't even think twice about it. They'll just do it. And they don't think that exists until it shows up at their doorstep. And then they're not prepared. And they think that some other, you know, I love law enforcement, but like my website, at the end of the day, like, you can't depend on them to protect you and your family. Like, you need to take that initiative. Every father, you know, and mother as well with their children, but you should be expected to protect your own family. You know, the law enforcement's there, you know, hopefully to help in the process, but the way society is going and how, you know, the release of these violent criminals, I mean, not just like your run of the mill drug dealer, like violent offenders, especially in my state, like releasing, like my state's pretty much like communist. I mean, they're releasing these violent offenders, like rapists and murderers, on bail. They passed, I can't remember, some law where, like, you know, they can get released with bail. That's insane. I mean, totally insane. And you're just gonna hope that, like, you know, you don't run into it face to face on your own level. Like, no, it can happen. And we're just getting worse. Things are just getting worse, worse and worse and worse. And, you know, it's, you have to be able to train yourself. And most people, they don't, with firearms, they're uncomfortable, you know, with the firearm, and they you have to train, you have to shoot it, you have to manipulate it, you have to, you know, load it multiple times, like all that in order to feel comfortable with it. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's worth it to pay a little bit of money. You know, you can take my courses or whatever, some company out there, learn that firearm versus taking your kids to Monkey Joe's or, you know, the ball house, and so that you can actually protect your family.
How do you incorporate that into your training, though? How do you get people to understand that maybe didn't understand that before, or just are not accepting that reality? How do you get that through in your training? We've said it numerous times. You're a big extrovert. You're loud, you're outspoken, but how do you get people to really take that to heart?
Basically, you know, I relate it to violent, you know, encounters in the SEAL teams, and like I talk about evil, and I talk about how evil exists, and, you know, how I've seen it face to face. And, you know, I bring up, I have, you know, guys that work for me, you know, that are in law enforcement, and they tell me stuff that's going around in the area that I live in, which is Peoria area, bad stuff. I mean, my brother's on the fire department there, and the fire truck was taking rounds over the fire truck the other day from a guy. Like, bad stuff. Like, you know, people going down to get something off of Facebook Marketplace on the southern end of town, and girl getting kidnapped. I mean, just, you know, that you need to tell them the reality of these things. And then, you know, in my PowerPoints, I show a couple different, you know, videos of different encounters and things like that, and talk about, you know, what you would do tactically, and how this would be applicable to you, you know, on a everyday basis type thing. But you have to, you know, it helps obviously with my pedigree and my background, and giving them firsthand, you know, evidence. 'Cause like, if I'm going to take a shooting class from somebody, or a firearms, I mean, ultimately a firearm is a sword, right? I mean, it's a sword, like ancient times, it's a sword. Would you go to, like, if you were a Viking, would you like want to learn from a dude that's actually killed guys in combat with that sword? Or would you want to learn from a dude that just carried the sword for a side piece? No, like, I want to go learn from someone that's actually used that in a real situation.
Not to say that there's not incredible shooters out there that can probably give, you know, better tips than I can with firearms, but I want to learn from someone that's done it for real. And so that's kind of the, what I solicit and what I sell with my stuff is like, hey, come learn from me, another Navy SEAL instructor of mine, two Peoria SWAT guys that are in it, you know, in it big time down in Peoria. And we'll try to, you know, translate this to a real life situation that you might encounter.
All right. What's the end game with vanilla guerrilla security?
The end game. I don't know. There's no end game. It's just, I love training law enforcement. I mean, I'm doing civilian stuff. I've done mostly civilian stuff for, you know, the last year, but I'm doing a lot more law enforcement stuff now, mainly because Illinois is kind of weird the way I was mentioning to you with the way law enforcement training happens in Illinois. Like I had to submit, I got my courses certified through the state so that officers can get credit for it. And then my instructors, you know, we got our Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board's accreditation so that we're accredited instructors. So my ultimate goal would be to just stick to doing, you know, law enforcement CQC stuff. That would be my goal in Illinois, like just kind of doing that, but I'll still do civilian stuff, but there's not really an end goal right now. It's just, I just love teaching and particularly CQC because it's fun and it always is challenging. I mean, firearms at the end of the day, especially, you know, with civilian firearms, it can get a little redundant, you know, and stale, and you got to be very careful with people that are showing up and their level, you know, what you can throw at them. But CQC is just fun because it's always, you know what I mean? Like, even if it's the same building, like the training building I have, each team is going to run it that same, you know, scenario differently. And I'm going to be able to debrief them differently and they're going to do something wrong. This team's going to do something wrong here. So it's just new. It's a different, fresher type of training that I enjoy. There's not really an end game other than I just want to teach dudes and put out, you know, what I learned in the team. So
I really, really wanted you to say world domination, but I guess that's not going to happen.
Well, yeah. Like, have Vanilla Gorilla just dominate the rest of the world. Yeah.
All right, here we go. Let's run through these last questions. And I think these are some of the most poignant about you. Best memory from childhood.
Best memory from childhood. Well, I don't want to get too long-winded, but my dad used to do with my crazy uncle where we'd go out and hunt. They would do these hay rides and they would call and they would do it around Halloween and stuff. They'd bring like churches from different areas out to do these hay rides. And they'd bring these poor city people out to the woods to do a hay ride. And in the hay ride, my dad would dress up like a homeless man and confront the back of the hay rack and talk with them. And the guy, my uncle driving, said that that's crazy Delbert Mason and he hasn't taken his meds. And then my dad would like get angry and disappear off into the woods with an axe. And I remember when I was real little, like, and I knew that this was happening. Like I knew what they were doing, but I was still scared as a kid. But we the hayride came through this and then it came to this riverbank. And then there was a little part on the riverbank where it kind of went up and my uncle would act like the tractor was stuck. And that hay rack was just kind of sitting in the river, not like underwater, but you know, in the river. And my dad was under the water with like moss over him, you know, breathing from a snorkel. And he came up out of the water with an axe at the back of the hay rack. I mean, people screaming, like I said, I knew this was happening and I was scared. But they would do that. They would run those things all the time. I mean, sadly, they wouldn't even tell them it was a joke. Like they would come back. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. My uncle would come back and they'd have hot dogs and, you know, do church music or whatever. And they'd tell him like, oh yeah, that's just Delbert Mason. I mean, there's probably some dude, you know, up by Chicago that's like my age that, you know, that still is having PTSD over that.
All right. That's going to be a pretty hard one to beat. Best memory in the military and the teams.
Oh man. Best memory. Probably when I posted a video about it, when we hooked up my one buddy, I won't tell his name, but his nickname after this incident was called the Legend. He's the guy that yelled Tits McGee over the radio after he shot all the dudes. But we were in Kuwait and we had a month. We were supposed to rotate in Afghanistan. We didn't end up going to Afghanistan. We went to Baghdad, but we had a month in Kuwait doing nothing and idle time for team guys is not good. But the moment we got there, we were right on the beach, our barracks, and we were, and for some reason, this one guy brought a paraglider with, I don't know why. I guess he thought he was going to go up to a mountain in Afghanistan and paraglide down to the base. That was his thinking behind bringing one on deployment. But we hooked it up to the Zodiac boat with about 300 foot of climbing rope. And his goal was to, we were going to lift him off. He was going to lift off the beach. He had this quick release thing that he was going to pop, and then he was going to fly back and land on the beach. Well, it went south, and he gets off the ground immediately.
Can I stop you and ask you how long it took before it went south?
Well, within seconds, because it was real windy on the beach. And, and mind you, our whole platoon's out there, including my platoon chief, like approving of this. All right. And the Army people weren't even allowed in the water. Like, they weren't even allowed to go in the water, and they're watching on the pier, and, you know, we're paragliding. And he hooked himself up, and within seconds, the Zodiac takes off. He's 300 feet, that whole length up in the air. And you could see him up there. He's trying to undo it. And it was so funny. We just thought it was hilarious at first. And then we're like, holy crap, he can't get undone. And then it lifted the Zodiac out of the water. And you can hear in the video.
Oh, like, my God.
Yeah, because of the wind and the power, like the whole back of the Zodiac was out of the water. In the video, if you listen to it carefully, you can hear like the motor's just running. And he drifted over, and literally he landed like 10 yards in front of that steel pier, wiped out into the water. But it was fun regardless. I mean, it was hilarious.
Oh my God. Hence
his nickname after that was the Legend.
I don't think it could be anything else than that. All right. Best memory of your family life.
My personal family?
Yes.
Yeah. Best memory of my family life. I don't know if I could drive it home to one particular memory. Like, we do a lot of rock climbing all over the country, you know, camping during the summer. But I would say probably just rock climbing, you know, the rock climbing trips we go on, and we vacation together all over the place and do outdoor activities and stuff.
I'm just trying to give you, because you said the last time you were on a podcast, your daughters were mad at you. So I was trying to give you an opportunity to make up for it.
One particular, like, you know, fun, you know, one particular memory, because there's so many memories. No, they were like, you didn't mention us at all. And because, you know, I love my kids, and like, I pretty much, my life is my kids. Like, if I'm not, you know, working or whatever, I'm trying to take them to do fun things. Because we homeschool. And so, you know, because you can bring your guns to school, you know, if you want.
That is true.
I have relations with the teacher. And so those are some benefits of homeschooling. But, you know, it's nice because they finish school and we can go do adventures. You know, we can go do all kinds of stuff, you know, that gives us the freedom to do that. But yeah, my daughters, you know, they're like, after I did the podcast, they're like, oh, are you getting famous now, Dad? And you didn't even talk about us. And I'm like, well, no, I'm
tried to get, I just wanted to know, and I tried to give you the opportunity. You did not take it. All right. Favorite movie of all time?
Oh, Predator.
Oh, really? Yeah. I mean, oh, yeah. It's great, but no, well, that's for a different time.
The Burbs is second.
Okay. The best piece of advice you could give in the life that you've lived to someone who is coming up just like you, or maybe someone that didn't come up like you, what's the best piece of advice you could give them about living their life?
So is this advice for someone that is going the trajectory military route, or is this just general?
Just you see someone that looks like they need advice in their life.
I would probably give them, you know, probably some spiritual, you know, advice with regard to God. That would probably be one thing that I would do for them. But the other thing that I would probably tell them is, don't neglect their family with regardless of what you do in your career and how much money you might make, how much, you know, fame you might get, or whatever it might be. Like, find a woman that will settle down with you, you know, have a family, and invest in your family. Because, you know, my daughters are, you know, I missed so much of their life, and, you know, you got, you know, teenage daughters as well, DJ. And like, all of a sudden they just went from like
young, you know, from in the teams, and now they're like women, and it just went like that. Like, we're a vapor, man, like that. And chasing money and chasing fame and power is a big fat goose egg at the end of the day. And all that's left when the dust settles is relationships. And so if you invest in those relationships and you invest in your family, if you don't have a family now, invest in the family members that, you know, you have. And then if you start a family, invest in that and invest in your children. And that's what I would tell them.
All right, let's talk about what's next for you with the security company, with you yourself. What do you got planned for next?
Just training law enforcement. So just working, you know, working that angle with, you know, I'm still working for another buddy that companies, some buddies of mine that run a company. They're all from development group guys. Like, I still work with them and train SWAT teams. But, with my company, is just to try to get the word out there and try to train a few more SWAT teams. And just that's kind of, you know, what I want to do. I just want to train SWAT teams. And, but I don't want to become some like massive company where I'm selling vanilla gorilla action figures. Like, you know, I partly because I don't want to take away from time spent with my family. Like our summers, like, and this goes back to the kind of what we talked about before, where it's hard for dudes to take a billet, you know, a shore billet. So my wife, you know, she'll keep up on this. Like, she knows if our business grows and I got all these law enforcement groups reaching out to me, I have a hard time saying, no, I won't train you. But, you know, I have to keep, you know, thread the needle. And if things get too busy, I don't want it to take over our summers of our camping and rock climbing, you know, and our family time, just because I can make some more money and train a SWAT team. Like, I'll just tell the team, nope, I can't do it then. I'm going on a vacation. Or, I mean, I don't need to tell them that, but, you know, I don't need to become some giant company or some giant social media star, because I don't care.
Well, that's a perfect answer from you. All right, where can people find you social media wise? Anything where they can find a little more about your story or connect with your company?
Obviously, my Instagram, Vanilla Gorilla Security, which is not a hard, you know, that's one of the easy things with when I had this company, I had this LLC when I worked for the CIA, and it was a joke when I made it back then, but it's nice because it's an easy, I tell somebody and they remember it, you know. But Instagram is Vanilla Gorilla Security. My Facebook, I think, is just Ben Wallach on my Facebook. Obviously, our website, vanillagorillasecurity.com. And then I have a YouTube, which is Vanilla Gorilla Security.
Man, I loved having you on. This has been so great. I'm so glad that we got together and got this done.
DJ, I appreciate, because like when I, I'm not a big podcaster, but when I saw that you had like Ty Smith on, who I went to Buds with, Eddie Penny, who I was at Two with before he went over to Dev Group, and Touche, who was my SQT instructor, I was like, why is this guy asking me to come on? You know what I mean? Like with guys that got way more bigger careers and done a lot better things than me. So I am very honored, you know, first and foremost, because, you know, you're a law enforcement guy and you got a probably, you know, even better background than I do. But I feel very fortunate that you even wanted to have me on. So,
well, I can't thank you enough for being on. Now, guys, you know where you can find Vanilla Gorilla or Ben. Let's talk about where you can find me. Now, I'm going to try and get through this. I told you I've got a little bit of a cold, so let's see if we can do it. First off, you can find me on Instagram at @DTD_podcast. You can find me on Facebook at @DTD_podcast, and you can find me on YouTube, where all these conversations, they're in video form. Your one-stop shop, it's DTDpodcast.net. Ben's going to have his own page. It's going to have the pictures that we talked about. It's going to have even more pictures that we talked about. But it's going to give you a little deeper look into Ben and his life and his story, which is an amazing thing. DTDpodcast.net. Make sure you stop by there. It covers everything that we're doing and everything that we're going to be doing. Now let's talk about the people that make this show possible. First off, let's talk about Mack Belts. We all know that nothing stands up to wear and tear like a good leather belt. If you're looking for the toughest leather belt on earth, then you've come to the right place. Mack's Belt. They are handcrafted in the USA by veterans who are serious about their craft. If you're looking for a belt that's tough enough for your active lifestyle and helps support those who've given so much to our country, look no further than Mack Belts. It's the toughest belt on the planet.
And the Mack Buckle, it consists of 100 plus grams of unbreakable American stainless steel, engineering designed, assembled, and machined in the USA by USA-built machines, backed by a multi-generation warranty. Expertly engineered to combine modern precision for rugged use, the Mack Buckle and brushed steel D-ring can be added to any Mack belt for a discounted price or purchased separately. Make sure you go check them out. A Mack belt is of the highest caliber of American craftsmanship, and they also positively impact our military charity partners. Mack belts, the toughest belt on earth at MackBelts.com. Now let's talk coffee. Police Coffee is an officer-owned business, and it's dedicated to crafting the finest coffees and blends, and they're shipped as soon as they're made to provide you with the freshest coffee available. Each batch, it's roasted fresh by people who know what it means to stay vigilant. And their specialty coffees do not waste one drop when flavor is concerned. Their coffee is some of the best you'll find, but it also serves an important cause. They give back to my community. 50% of their profits go towards helping family members of police officers who fell in the line of duty. And I want to talk about my favorite flavor from them. It's One Ranger, and it's a flavored coffee that you're sure to love. It's flavorful, medium-bodied coffee with a smooth and sweet pecan flavor. Now, pecan coffee, as I always say, is probably the best combination in the world. The pecan's rich, sweet, nutty, and buttery flavor cuts right through coffee's natural acidity to give you a smooth and satisfying coffee experience. And if you go to policecoffee.com, you can pick up K-cups, whole bean, ground, dog treats, coffee mugs, anything that you need to start your day or to drink your coffee is there. And if you put DJK10 in, you get 10% off your order. Guys, make sure you go by here and help these guys out. They make the show possible. MackBelts.com, PoliceCoffee.com. That's going to be it because I think my voice is finally giving out. That's been the Vanilla Gorilla. I'm DJ. This has been the show. Catch us on the next one. We're out of here. See you later.